cerebral palsy awareness and understanding in adults isn't really much of a thing. Like, a lot of the care stops with babies and with kids, right? So to go in as an adult and be like, hey, I need help, they're a bit like, whoa, do you?
Hi, I'm Brooke Milhouse. Welcome to Disabled and Proud, the podcast that does exactly what it says on the tin. Each week, the show highlights an awesome disabled guest speaking about their own disability, why they're proud to be disabled, and why they're proud to be themselves.
Abby, welcome to Disabled and Proud. How are you today?
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. It's been a mad week, but all my weeks tend to be quite mad. So this has been like a different madness. It's been up and down, but good. It's been good. I'm looking forward to today, though. We're delving into loads of different bits and pieces and we'll have a fun chat. It'll be really good.
Yeah, I'm excited. I've kind of had my eyes on your pod for a while, as you know. So I'm like, Brooke, let me on. Let's talk. So yeah.
Amazing. So the first question that I ask absolutely every single guest is, how do you refer to your disability?
Oh, well, generally I just say I have cerebral palsy, and the two like default responses I get are, what's that? Or, oh, my mum's cousin's mate has that and you don't look the same as them. So it's one of those two responses I get, but I straight up just say that I have cerebral palsy. In the event that somebody does know what it is, they're like, oh, what type do you have? And I'm like, oh, okay, like somebody knows what they're talking about, and I'm fairly open. But generally, I'll just say I have cerebral palsy, it affects my mobility, and it's a whole left side of my body.
Interesting, because I didn't know that there were different types of CP. So talk to me about that, because I always thought that it was kind of, which is very, very like naive of me and also ignorant considering this is what we do, to talk about this. But talk to me about different types, and with different types, does that mean there's different is it like symptomatic, is it like genetic based, like how does it all work essentially?
So I'd probably like to focus more on my type, just because it's like my experience and the one I feel most kind of authentic to talk about. But I have hemiplegia, which is like half your body. And there's paraplegia and quadriplegia. And so it's kind of like your body's in fractions, I guess, and like different sections, arms, legs. So I have hemiplegia on my left side, which means like everything on my left side is affected. Coordination is mostly for me, but also that's the side where I get pain, but then I also get pain on my right side because it's compensating for my left side. My eyesight's weaker, my balance isn't good, my dexterity isn't as good, which are generally, I would say, which are kind of generally the same for all types of CP, but then because it's brain damage, right, different sections of your brain are affected, which ultimately is going to mean that it affects you in slightly different ways. Mine is this like right back chunk of my brain, my cerebellum, which is all about like coordination, dexterity, maths. Like I'm not a mathematical or a sporty person, let's put it that way, but that's kind of how it affects me, which is fairly similar across the board to people that I've spoken to with CP, but there are changes because it's different parts of your brain essentially.
Yeah, I love that. It's again, it's that whole idea that we like to slap a big label on something and be like, everybody's the same, and it's just not the case. Like, disability is this massive umbrella term, and actually it's the same with CP as well, because you're so right, you're talking about your own experience, but when we're talking about different parts of the brain, it all links to different parts of the body. So what may affect one person one place is going to affect someone else differently in another place. And like, you know, that's literally how the brain and the body work. So it's good to have that perspective on it, because I don't think that part of CP gets spoken about very much publicly. Like, what we know is that it can affect movement, or it can affect speech, or like how you go about your day-to-day life. But actually, when we think of it in terms of the brain, it makes sense more.
Totally. And I think in terms of my hemi and the way it affects me, for people that kind of don't really know it, my understanding, and from when I've spoken to people, is that my how it affects me is quite similar to ataxia. So then if people know what ataxia is, then they can kind of have a little think about certainly this type of cerebral palsy. and kind of how it affects me. I met somebody on a job recently who also has HEMI, and she also has it on her left side. We were like, oh my God, like we had so much to talk about. But even so, even though we have same brain damage, same-ish place, we're still totally different. We had a lot of similarities, sure, and we had a lot of like bonding, like, oh, don't you hate it when this happens, or like this, that and the other. But then mm-hmm. there were things that differed for both of us. And like, the brain is such a complex organ, right? So it is going to be different for everybody.
Yeah. And with that in mind, obviously CP happens like when you're incredibly, incredibly young.
Hmm.
What was childhood and that growing up experience like for you as a disabled child?
Oh, I was a wobbly kid, you know. I didn't walk. I didn't walk until I was two. I used to have to wear these little shoes called Pietro boots. At the time, I thought they were super nerdy and super embarrassing, but now I'm like, oh, they're quite cool. Just generally, everything was a bit slower. I think my parents say that I was super creative and like always scribbling and writing. I was never one for like being that sporty and stuff anyway, whether that's because I felt mm-hmm. I couldn't manage or whether I just wasn't interested. I'd rather write stories about like princesses and dragons and stuff. But I don't really remember much as a little kid. I think more as I went into like adolescence and like secondary school, that's where I really kind of noticed that I had a disability, because even though I knew before, mm-hmm. it wasn't spoken about a whole lot, because I kind of like it was mild, right? And it is mild, and I kind of got on with it. But going into secondary school, where we know people can be a little bit meaner, you know, yeah. you're growing up, your body's changing, you're having to be more independent. That's kind of when I noticed for me what having CP kind of meant for me and how it made me different, mm-hmm. which at the time I loathed, but now I just embrace it. I don't care. Yeah.
I think it's so interesting when we talk, particularly when I talk to people who are disabled during like adolescence and their experience with that, because it tends to be around about that time that you kind of realize that you are different from like the general population. And obviously like everybody at that age is going through changes, hormones are like absolutely raging, like you don't know who you are, you think you know everything but actually you know nothing, and you're kind of figuring out your space in the world. And I'm always really intrigued to hear about what it's like for disabled people to go through that as well, because not only are you contending with like what everybody else is contending with, which is the hormones like changing, your body's changing, everything is different, but you're also adding in a disability to that as well, which is kind of like another, like an extra added level of stress, because that is so different from everybody else and you can't change anything about that. There's nothing that you can do to make it better or to make it worse, or to like, you kind of just have to learn how to grow with it. And it's so interesting being able to have these conversations, because everybody says the exact same thing. It's around about adolescence when you realize that actually you are different in terms of how you navigate the world. And how was school for you? Because being a disabled woman, being a disabled child, can be really difficult, and particularly in a scholastic system, because let's be honest, scholastic systems are not built for disabled kids at all, like regardless of what your disability is. And what was your experience like at school, and did you have any barriers whilst you were there?
Oh yeah, I had quite a few. I mean, for a start, like a lot of my teachers didn't even know, because I think I wasn't at the stage where I was kind of embracing it. My parents, not in a bad way, but didn't think it needed to be mentioned, because like I wasn't visibly struggling. But I think you know, walking around, this is more specific to me, but like walking around a secondary school is tough. They're quite big spaces, the stairs, like something that still freaks me out to this day, and I notice this when I go into like cinemas or places without handrails, is like when the bell rings and people are running up and down the stairs and like you can't get to a handrail, and like just that like really freaks me out. I know it sounds like a little thing, but like the idea of falling over or people making fun of me or like shoving me out the way, just feeling unsafe, I think that was kind of the main thing. I kind of struggled finding school shoes. I wasn't wearing those special boots anymore, but I kind of struggled to find school shoes, and we found that although they were heavy, Doc Martens were like super supportive. And I got penalised for those because they had yellow stitching on, and I got put into like isolation. And then my mum came in and she was like, that's supportive footwear. And I was like, yeah, supportive footwear. And they were like, you can't have it, it's yellow stitching. It was the whole thing. And I was like, for God's sake, like this is their priority. It's like, you're not fitting in with the standard, even though these shoes are actually helping you. They weren't like the boots. They were like the kind of flat ones. They looked a little bit like trainers. Anyway, they were not happy. And another thing that I remember is there was a school trip to go skiing. Like I said to you, Brooke, I'm not a sporty kid. But if someone tells me I can't do something, like if someone tells me, Abby, you can't do that, you best believe I'm going to do it anyway. And so a ski trip came up. I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. Like all my friends were going and it was a thing. Like it was a whole, like going to Austria and like little residential. And the head teacher kind of tried to be discreet and like got my mum in and was like, oh, we don't think Abby's really going to be able to cope with this. It can be quite challenging. Sorry. I was there like, and I remember leaving with my mum being like, mum, I think I should go. And she's like, yeah, I think you should go. So we kind of kicked up a bit of a fuss there because, I mean, firstly, why should we have to? Just because they're like not equipped in kind of the like, oh, we can't let a disabled kid go on the trip. All sorts of things could happen. They might not manage skiing. What will we do? Who's going to look after them? All of this stuff. And Brooke, like, I wasn't very good. I sucked. I was on baby slopes the whole time, but I went and I enjoyed it. But it was a real... like had to really kick up a fuss to actually do that. And that really sticks with me too, because I don't know what that teacher was thinking, whether they were concerned from like a health and safety standpoint. I don't know. But at the time that just felt super isolating. But I was like, nah, I'm going to go anyway, you know, because I'm going to be told by this bloke what to do. I'm actually not. But yeah, they're the kind of things that kind of stick out to me from secondary school.
It's so interesting that it's such a blatant form of ableism. Like, yeah, so blatant, so like straight to your face. No ifs, no buts. You're a health and safety hazard. We don't want to deal with you. Like your issues are your priority, and we can't take responsibility for that. And it is horrible that you had to experience that. And I'm sorry that you had to have that experience. But what's so interesting is that how that stuck with you means that you will make sure nobody ever feels that way, which is like a horrible way of looking at it. But actually, when we think about it, like I know I've had similar experiences and I'm like, I will make sure 100% nobody ever feels that way regarding like what they believe they can and can't do. And also, I think when someone automatically judges you on their perception of what you can and can't do, it kind of lights a bit of a fire underneath you. At least for me, like very much like a, like me talking about myself. But it kind of wants me to make me be like, well, fuck you. Like, just because you've perceived me with a disability doesn't mean that you have the right answers. You're like, I'm going to prove you wrong. And that fire definitely comes from that for me. And I have a feeling you're the same.
Oh, yeah, big time. I was like, I'm going skiing, like, period. You can sort it out amongst yourselves, you lot. I don't care. I'm going. it's one of those things. That, you're right. That has stuck with me for sure. Like, I really don't appreciate when people think that I can't do something, because I'll be the one to tell them. I'll be the one to say, do you know what I mean? Yeah. I know my body, I know my limitations, I know my struggles, but I also know what I can do. And I don't think anybody should have that voice taken away from them.
I love that because I completely agree with you. And I love what you said about nobody should have their voice taken away from them, because that's not something we really talk about enough when we're talking about disability, is how often other people speak for us rather than us speaking for ourselves. And actually, just because you said that, it's like it sparked something inside of me. When it comes to obviously dealing with doctors and all of that kind of stuff, how do you find that? Do you find that you get doctors who are understanding and they listen to you? Or do you find that sometimes you're just passed from pillar to post?
Well, I think... I can probably guarantee that, you know, you might relate to this as well, and a lot of other kind of women who will listen to this, disabled women in particular. Oh, it's just hormonal. Do you know? Like, oh, it's just hormonal. Oh, you're just, you know, you're struggling with this because of this. I've had that so many times. And I'm like, dude, I literally have brain damage. Like, what is wrong with you? Like, stop telling me it's period pain. Like, leave off. Yeah. Look at my brain scan. So, I mean, I've had a kind of mixed bag, really. I now have a very good doctor who kind of knows my history in detail and kind of been really supportive about me getting more brain scans and things like that. But unfortunately, for 80% of it, it's just been like, oh, well, you know, it has been like, you look all right. And like, for that to come from a doctor, to me, is just wild. I mean, I guess they want to see people who look well, right? They're like, they just want to get them in and out so they can, you know, help people. But if somebody's coming to you to be like, I don't feel like I'm getting enough support, because I didn't feel like that for a long time. I stopped getting any kind of support from my CP when I was like 7. I didn't have a brain scan then until I was 17. It's like a 10-year gap. And that includes the kind of adolescence part of it. But yeah, I think it's kind of been one of those things, because although my brain damage, like if you look at it, if you look at the photo or the scan, it's quite a substantial part of damage, Brooke. It's like a quarter of my brain is like blacked out. Yeah. But obviously how it presents itself within me and externally to other people is quite mild, so it has been quite hard to even get like medical professionals to listen to me sometimes, but I do have a really good doctor now, so yeah, it's been a bit of a journey with that.
It's always fascinating talking particularly to women or those who are femme presenting about their experiences with doctors because of that. And I think what you said about how you present really, like, you present well, and for doctors to be like, oh, you look fine, so they almost pie you off because actually, like, on the surface you look fine, but actually underneath there's quite a lot going on, is a lot to be said for how doctors deal with disability. And to be quite honest, like, I don't know a disabled person who isn't an expert in their own disability and in themselves and in how they, like, and as you said, like, they know that, like, I know my limitations, you know your limitations so much better than any doctor would. And it blows my brain to this day that doctors still don't listen to people with disabilities when we know, like, factually, we know ourselves so much better than anybody else. And we also know our conditions so much better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated to have those conversations, because it almost, like, reinforces that actually doctors don't know everything. So in the nicest way possible, don't rely on them for your answers. If you feel you have your own answers, like, go ahead and sort it out yourself if you can, and almost present your evidence to your doctor in a way that can be like, I have all the evidence here, these are all my notes, these are all my everything, now do something about it. Because without that evidence, you can't really do anything with it. And again, it's like it's a lot of laborious long work, right? Like, but it is part and parcel of being disabled, and until we can change the narrative and until we can change how the, like, medical system works, that's what we've got to do to get what we need.
I know, it's so true. Do you know, I was just thinking as you were talking then, I've had more support for polycystic ovaries than I have my lifelong disability. Like, and when I think about that, it really does kind of show to me that, you know, doctors really aren't disability savvy. And especially cerebral palsy awareness and understanding in adults isn't really much of a thing. Like, a lot of the care stops with with babies and with kids, right? So to go in as an adult, we're like, hey, I need help. They're a bit like, whoa, do you? Like, you know, because they're so used to helping babies.
Are you sure?
How to walk. Yeah, exactly. So I'm working with this really great charity at the moment called UP, the UP CP movement, and they're kind of all about cerebral palsy awareness in adults, because people just, like, they just think we disappear, Brooke, or something. I don't even know. But, like, there's definitely a gap with the support system, for sure.
Very, very interesting. Again, it's a, like, and I've said it before, is that disabled children are so supported, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody wants you to do it amazing, and everybody's really there to help you and push you and give you all the support you need. And then maybe, I think maybe it's around about that adolescent age again, is that suddenly all this support stops and actually become a bit more of a hindrance. Mm-hmm. And it's such a turn, and it's quite immediate, really. It's almost like you qualify for support up until you're like, what, 10, and then at 10 years old it gets taken away from you, and that's it, and you're left to fend for yourself. And it's very interesting that you're now part of something that's bringing awareness, particularly for adults, because as you said, like, where is your support? Because like you said, like, you've learned to walk, which is what doctors perceive as the problem. You've learned to do this, you've learned to do that, and doctors can't figure out what other help that you need.
Exactly. But it's like, we don't have a full understanding of independence as a kid. You don't have to learn how to get yourself dressed. You don't have to learn how to cook. You don't have to learn how to clean. You don't have to learn how to manage walking to the bus stop, navigating the bus without a seat, then doing school for the whole day, then going home. Like, do you know what I mean? You don't have to do that when you're a baby. So how can people possibly judge, like, that you're okay when you haven't even really done life yet and you haven't done the things that are required of, like, an independent adolescent through to adult?
Yeah. Interesting that we're having this conversation, because I love it and I'm finding it very fascinating. But when you were thinking about, like, your career choices and what you wanted to do as an adult, did at any point your disability, like, come into that, like, conversation that you were having with yourself? Was there a point in time where you were thinking about how much your disability would impact your career?
Massively. And I kind of love this question, because it's sort of the reason why I started my talent agency in the first place. Because I always kind of knew that I was wanting to work in something creative, and then later on film and TV. And I did my undergrad in film, and then I kind of finished that and I was like, oh man, I don't know how I'm going to go and get a job as, like, a runner and be on set 12 hours a day, or how am I going to go and be an intern and, like, be in a workshop for 12 hours a day or whatever. I was like, there's just no, like, I just don't feel like I can do that. And I think at that point, because this was shortly after I had my brain scan as well, Brooke, I think I had a lot of internalized ableism about myself, which I've now shifted. But at that time, I think because of experiences I'd had up until that point, I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to manage that. But in a way, that thinking that I had was kind of a blessing, because I wrapped up my degree, was really freaked out. And then I was like, oh, well, I know a lot about film. I've done a few little bits of, like, acting work. I made a couple of shorts and things, but I don't know a lot about business, right? So I thought, why don't I go do a master's in business, get my head clued up, and then maybe I can go into distribution or film financing or something like that. So did my master's in creative arts management, which was really fun because it was like business, but, like, not as boring. Like, it had a bit of a spicy twist on it, like, kind of creatively inclined, which is what I needed, because I think otherwise I'd been a bit bored. And I was still in the back of my mind, like, what am I going to do for work? I can't manage this. This isn't sustainable for me. And then I kind of thought, I'm going to, like, start a talent agency, because I'd known so many actors. I'd always been that person at uni that, like, would connect people, like, she's the guy who knows a guy kind of thing. And I was like, well, why not do that? Because I know so many actors in my area of Hampshire at the time. We expanded later on, but I was like, these people kind of need support and a bit of nurturing, because they don't necessarily know where to go in their career. And I think I can help with that. It's a win-win, right? I'm getting in the industry, I'm helping people, and I'm kind of doing something that's within what I always wanted to do, but is a lot more meaningful, I think. And so I put a real diversity focus on my agency. But then, weirdly, as time went on, I kind of started applying for, like, film jobs anyway, just along the side of my agency. And then all of a sudden, there's me going, oh, I can't work on set for that many hours a day, I can't manage it, to then being hired and working for Disney and working on a Hollywood film, which was nuts. So like, I don't know where that shift happened within me. Well, I think starting my agency gave me a lot of confidence, and seeing myself kind of help other people and figure out how to, you know, they want to work in the industry, right? How can we make the industry work for them in terms of access and things? Then that kind of spurred me on to be like, ah, do you know what? I'm just going to, like, throw my hat in the ring. And then I went and worked on this really big film, which was wild and really, really hard. And admittedly, not the most accessible experience, but still good, and taught me a lot about my own stamina and my own abilities.
I love that you were like, do you know what? I'm just going to throw my hat in the ring. Why shouldn't I, and why not? But with that, when you were on set and you were doing all this, like, like you said, like the long days and working around the things that you wanted to be in, did you find that you were asking for like your access needs there and then, or was it something that like gradually came with confidence, or were you kind of able to verbalize what you needed? And also adding on to that question, were you given the support and the access needs that you needed?
So I'm just going to be totally like candid about this whole experience because I think it's important. I was actually hired on a diversity scheme for this, mm-hmm. which made me quite hopeful about the support that I was going to get. Largely, I felt that I could kind of ask for what I needed. I mean, this was a few years ago now, and it makes me realize how far access has come, because at this point there were no, I think it was like 2021 I did this, maybe 2020, just after COVID. And at this point we had like no access riders or access passports and stuff. So it was more of a loose conversation mm-hmm. of like, oh, I might need to sit down with other people. Also, point to note, I was working in costume and I totally blagged it because I can't sew. I find irons too heavy. I'm not very good at steaming. I totally blagged it. I had an amazing time and I learned a lot. But something that I noticed was that because of the nature of the production and with it being like quite a big Hollywood film and being a trainee and being like, I don't want to get fired, I felt that I could be a lot more vocal about my access requirements with some people compared to other people. So I definitely found my allies very quickly. And so like, although I did have some support, I found myself masking quite a lot, and I did get like super run down, and I kind of, when I wasn't at the studios, I'd be sleeping. It was really, really hard. I mean, I'm glad I did it for sure, but 9 months was a long, long time. And I think even now, because I work in access now, I can see such a huge difference and progression in the way that the industry's going. Yeah, it was tough, definitely.
Yeah. I think that's one of those universal experiences that disabled people have, is that we go into jobs, regardless of whether we believe we can or we can't do them, because mm-hmm. we're proving a point. And then it's almost like we're doing it, but at what cost to ourselves? Because you're right, like, as you said, you were sleeping loads, and at the end of the 9 months, you were kind of like, I'm good, like I've done it. I need to have like a rest or a chill. And it's that tenacity in us. But also, I like what you said, harking back to what you said earlier about the internalized ableism you had, because that also kind of ties into it as well, doesn't it? Because you want to keep up and you want to be just like everybody else and not like, and it ties into also what you said about you found your allies very, very quickly. Like you found the people that you could confide in and there were certain people that you just couldn't, because like you said, you didn't want to run the risk of getting fired. And it,
which is such an old fashioned thing to think, right?
It is, and it's such, it kind of like runs into a really rich tapestry as to why disabled people are the way they are when it comes to work. Because on the one hand, you really want to prove yourself and you really want to show people that you can be just like everybody else. On the other hand, there are certain things that actually go past the limits, but we also have this innate fear of being fired or not being looked after or having something happen to us that we can't control. And it's a very interesting conversation, because now that you work in access, can you see where the access needs of other people are like way more benefited now than what they were previously?
Massively. It's almost like a Where's Wally or like a Spot the Difference game. When I think about the access that I know about now, and I think about the situation I was in, it's like, oh, that could have been done. Mm-hmm. Fair enough if people don't know, but like I said at the start of that, like I was hired on a diversity scheme, so to me, I thought the support was going to be very different. But if they don't have those experts, then they're not going to know. I mean, that's a really poor excuse, and I think people should be more accountable and should be kind of educated, particularly in film and TV. But yeah, I look back and I'm like, oh, like things could have been done so differently. But I think had I been, it's a really tough one, isn't it? Because I'm like, had I been braver and spoken out more? But at the same time, you are a trainee on like a huge, huge Hollywood film. Like, you know, it's you're working with the big dogs. They don't have time. They don't have time, right or wrong. They don't have time and they don't want to know. And I think especially the older generation, they just want to carry on. And you can't change everyone. But like I said, like the allies that I did find and the people that I spoke to, I think I had support, but I did my fair share of like sharing, not just about cerebral palsy, but disability awareness in general. And to me, I did a good job with that. So I kind of take that forward as well.
Yeah. And that is so important, isn't it? Is that, you know, having that voice that you've shared, like you shared your own opinion, like you said, but also there are certain things that we can all speak about because it's common things that we all go through, and being able to share that in a place where it's not sometimes always welcomed is actually kind of invaluable, because that's when like little bits of change start to happen, whether we realize it or not. But I was wondering, through any hardship that you've had, can you look back and notice a positive trait about yourself that you're actually really proud of, that you fostered?
I'm super resilient, Brooke, now. Like, I'm super resilient. I'm super stubborn. And I'm not afraid to, I guess, educate, like, in a nice way. You know, I don't know everything about everything, but I think because of the people that I've met and, I don't know, the film sets I've been on and the comments I've heard and the ignorance, I am going to say ignorance from some people, because it has been the case. Mm-hmm. I'm now like not afraid to speak out through doing my access work and through my own kind of journey within the film and TV world. Because I think in an industry like that, you know, what is one thing to be a woman and it's another thing to be disabled. And then when you're both, it's like, oh, really, really, really got to work hard here now to kind of make sure that my voice is heard. And that I'm amplifying other people's voices as well, I think is really important.
Yeah. And I like what you said about, you know, like being a woman is one thing, but being a disabled woman is another. And like the two together is almost like, you know, you're almost hitting a jackpot of like diversity. So like you're a massive tick, but actually whilst you're a massive tick, is the things that should be being done, are they being done? And if they're not, have you got a voice that's loud enough to be able to cut through it and be like, actually, I just don't think you guys are hitting the mark? And having that confidence is like so important, but it's confidence that comes from experience. I feel like I'm okay to say that, because
absolutely,
you can be born with confidence, but there's a big difference in being able to look back on your life and being like, okay, I have all the evidence I have behind me to show that I should be confident in this, and I know that I can speak about it. And that's kind of invaluable when it comes to being able to educate in the right way.
No, I agree. And it's taken me a lot to get there. Like, I still wouldn't say I am super confident, but I definitely know the things that I want to speak about the loudest, and I'm like not afraid to do that anymore.
Yeah. I love that. I think being able to speak about what you want is so important in this, like in life in general, because if you don't, you just bottle it and keep it all inside, and that's never good for anyone.
No, so true.
I wonder, do you have another piece of advice for a younger version of yourself?
Don't hide, like whether that's like literally hiding. I used to do that sometimes when I worked on this job. I'd like go and hide by the washing machines just for a minute. But also don't feel the need to hide part of yourself. Because I think about, I mean, especially kind of in the last 10 years, wow, that has been a long time. Like 10 years is when I've kind of been properly working in film and stuff. Because I think about opportunities I may have had kind of pre-18 and in my adolescence and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think like I didn't take a lot of opportunities. I didn't think I could, which is kind of sad. I feel bad for little me, but I think little me would be proud of like bigger me now, for kind of all the stuff I've done and the fact that I'm not hiding anymore, and the fact that I want to help people. Because I think, especially now where I'm finally getting to a point, like I said, it's been 10 years, it's been a long time. I've done a lot of stuff, but I now feel like I'm at the point where I'm making traction. But to me, like passing the ladder back down to the little me or like little somebody else is like almost as important as the work itself. And I never want to lose sight of that, whether it's like supporting someone on their journey with getting into the industry, whether it's somebody kind of on a personal journey with their identity about their cerebral palsy or other disability, whether it's about access, like helping people is so important to me. And that's kind of what pushes me forward. But I think that's probably because little me wanted more help than she had.
Yeah. That's what I was about to ask next. I was like, did little version of you, did she have the support that she wanted? And is that where that comes from?
Yeah, I mean, from family and stuff, yeah, sure. But I think even like within myself, there was quite a bit of self-loathing as to why I was different and things like that. And then my friends didn't really understand. And then like with school and then like with college. So probably not as much as I would have liked, which is now why I'm like, yeah, I want to help everyone. I want to do everything. I'm, you know, I'm unapologetic now. I'm just going to do stuff. So it's good.
I love that, that you said I'm unapologetic, because I think all, I think there's so much to be said for unapologetic disabled women. Mm-hmm. And it's my favorite thing, because for so long, disabled women were hidden. And we only have to think back to like the ugly laws in America, where disabled people just couldn't even be outside because they were deemed as ugly, which is
makes me sick.
Issue in and of itself. But to be an unapologetic disabled woman in this world is no mean feat. And particularly working in TV and industry, when so much of the job is actually can be based on aesthetics and how well you do something, to show up in a space that is very much driven by that and be like, do you know what, like that's not how this is going to work for me. And particularly now that you're working in access, being able to be that voice for someone else is so imperative. And by you being there is going to be helping so many other people realize that A, they can work in film and TV, and that is incredible, and have that disabled representation. But you're also like, you're healing a part of yourself, which sounds incredibly woo-woo, and I'm so aware of that. But actually, like, I'm a big believer of being able to do that for yourself, because ultimately, bit of a morbid like statement, but we come into this world alone and we die alone in this world. And like, you can have all the love you want from family, friends, partners, whoever, but actually you've got to be good with yourself, because you're with yourself for the longest amount of time. And we touched on that internalized ableism. If we don't pick apart that internalized ableism and kind of figure out as to why it makes us upset or sad or feel like we're different or othered, then it's only going to get worse as time goes on. And we've got to almost be brave enough to have the conversation with ourselves to be like, is this actually genuinely something I believe? Or is this something society has told me to believe about myself? Now, which one is it? And sometimes it can be really uncomfortable and really ugly, but being able to do that is so invaluable.
I agree. It's a lot to work through, but it is, I think I'm a lot more comfortable with myself now. Even like little things, I'm gonna like keep it lighthearted, but you know, I used to go to a restaurant and let's say the bathroom is downstairs, down like really horrible steep stairs, I would just like sit in that restaurant and like not go pee the whole time, be sat in there for 3 hours. Whereas now I'll walk in the restaurant, be like, no, it's not gonna work for me, and I'll leave and I'll pick a new restaurant. Like, I don't care. Like, and I know it's only a little thing, but like for me, for such a long time, even things like that were like, oh, I don't want to be a burden, I don't want to, you know, like make things tricky, I don't want you know, I don't want to make things difficult. And like, if you can't get to the bathroom, it's not like making things difficult, is it? I don't think so. No. Even like whether it's something more deep like work and the messages I'm trying to spread, or whether it's my day-to-day life, like that's not going to work for me. I think both are just as important.
A phrase that I like to remember, and actually I think it's a really valuable one, is that everybody poos. Like everybody does, so you've got to be comfortable with it, because if you're not, everybody does it. Like,
yeah, no, you're so right, you're so right. I just, yeah, I'm just done with like hiding parts of myself. It's taken a long time to get there, do you know? And you know, by the time I'm 30, I've given myself 2 years to be the most confident ever. Like to not be doubting anything. No,
but I think that's really, I do think that's really valuable though, to be like, actually, do you know what, it is a journey, because it's not necessarily something that happens overnight.
No.
It's drilled into you from such a young age, particularly when you are a disabled child. And you know, if you acquire your disability, it's a whole different ball game. And to, like, obviously we're not talking about that today, because that's neither one of our experiences, but being able to realize that it takes a long time is like almost just as powerful as realizing that the system that wants us to be down and oppressed isn't the one that's working for us.
Yeah.
And again, sounds super woo-woo, but it's true. Like being able to recognize, do you know what, it's going to take a little bit of time to build that confidence. It's not necessarily something that happens overnight. is actually kind of exciting, because where are you going to be in 2 years' time? How exactly exciting is that?
Yeah, this is what I think. And do you know what as well? This is going to sound super cheesy, but I do mean it. I think something that has really helped me, particularly in the last couple of years, while I've been finding my voice more and like using my platform and doing access work, is like finding my community as well. Like finding other people with lived experience who are a similar age to me. Like that in itself, having like a peer group and a friend group. Some are, in fact, most are in the creative industries, not all of them, but that in itself has been so valuable to me, because it's like I found my people. You know, not saying like, oh, I'm only friends with them because they have disabilities like me. I'm not saying that at all, but I think it really helps a lot to meet others who have the same kind of message as you and who are on the same journey of like wanting to do the cool stuff, wanting to be independent, but have lived experience. I feel so safe in those spaces. I feel so safe talking to those people. And I think that's hugely, hugely helped my kind of journey in the last couple of years.
And what you just said there about feeling safe in those spaces is so important, because quite often as disabled people we can be denied that safety or we have to rely on like others, and I'm not talking about like family, friends, I'm talking about like others out in the public. We kind of have to rely on them for safetiness and safetiness, is that even a word?
Is now.
Oh my God, I don't think it is. I think I just made it up. You know when you like shock yourself because you're like, it doesn't even sound like English. But we do have to rely on that safety from others, whether it makes us feel safe or not.
Yeah.
But actually, you're right, having that community in that space where people can understand and have similar lived experience and can empathize, that there really is nothing like it.
I know, it's made such a difference to me. Because I think even like I use Instagram a lot, I know we both do, but like even kind of shifting the dial on the kind of content I consume now is really motivating for me. And really inspiring, like seeing the people I admire that I'm friends with, like showing up and doing amazing work, as well as using their platform for advocacy and allyship as well. Like to me, that's been so powerful.
Yeah. I would love to know if you've had any bizarre questions over the years surrounding your disability, because we all know that people love to ask us weird questions, but is there like a particular set of odd questions that you get surrounding it, where either you have like a super quick, like almost like your go-to response, or you think, oh, not this question again, or just something that always kind of gets asked and you're like, I don't know where it comes from. Like, who thought that you could ask that?
This is so funny to me, because yes, and they're always, almost always the same. I have the looks me up and down. How'd you get that then? Oh, you know, I just went outside and caught cerebral palsy, like shit. Like it's so silly. How'd you get that then? Are you going to die? Like, you know, is it terminal? Yeah. Cause like if people do know it's a brain thing, I'm like, no, relax. Like it's non-progressive. Like I might get arthritis a bit sooner than other people, but I'm, you know, honestly, not the question, but the classic, you don't look disabled, or oh my God, this makes me ill. I got this at Cannes so much last year, and I was trying to be like, cause it's Cannes and you have to do this schmoozy, stupid thing. But people being like, oh, blimey, darling, you handle that well. You hide that well. And these are from, like, old man execs that, like, just, you're there, you're stood there. Like, I actually feel sick. I actually feel sick that you're saying that to me. You hide that well. And I'm like, I'm not hiding. I'm not hiding anything. For me, they're the defaults, yeah, but like pretty sickening, to be honest. I've got quite thick skin about it now, and I'll call it out and be like, oh, I'm not hiding anything. Or I'll be like, I have cerebral palsy, do you know what it is? And they'll be like, no. I'm like, well, let me tell you, have you got 5 minutes? Like, I don't care, you know.
Shall we go for a sit down chat?
yeah, you want to tell me, like, oh, you hide it, like, yeah, you don't look like you have that. I'm like, oh, like people think it's flattery though. And it's not. I'm not flattered, because I'm not ashamed and I'm not hiding anything. So Like, oh, that grosses me out, Brooke, honestly. I find it gross.
I can't believe what you said about, are you going to die?
Oh, I know. I know.
Like, what, firstly, like, what a morbid question to ask someone.
Oh, yeah.
But secondly, you don't know what kind of traumatic trigger that could be for someone. And, like, it people blow my mind. Don't get me wrong. I love people. I find people fascinating. But this particular question always opens my eyes to just how fucking weird the general public are.
Yeah. Literally. Like, and I, sometimes I'm shocked. I'm, like, frozen. Like, I don't even know how to respond to it. I can think of 100 ways in my head, but you know when somebody actually asks you something and you're so caught off guard, you're like, is this real life? Like, is this happening? Why would somebody ask me
that? Did this just happen?
Yeah, I know, right? Because it's just so invasive. And so, like you said, could bring up trauma for somebody. And just like, it's just a bit personal, isn't it? Like, it's just a bit, you know, so many other things you could ask me. Yeah, they're the main kind of default ones, and it's the extremities to me. For somebody saying you hide that well, to somebody being like, are you gonna die? I'm like, do you know what I mean? They're very, very
they're opposite. Polar opposites, because on one hand you're being like celebrated for like quote unquote hiding your disability, and then on the other hand you're literally being asked, so is it gonna kill you?
Yeah.
Like, well done, you've hidden it well, but like, are you going to die from this? And it's almost like, what I find particularly fascinating about that is almost like, are you going to die from it? Not asking because you care about whether or not you're going to die, but actually, like, how can I avoid dying from the same thing?
Yeah, I think it is a lot of that, you know? I do.
Yeah.
Oh,
because we've got this. Whether or not people realise it, people still very much have a fear of disability and almost, like you said, like, you know, when people are asking you, like, oh, how did you get that or what happened? Mm-hmm. It's like, they're asking you, like, yeah, they're asking you to ask you, but underlying is that sense of, if I ask you, then I know how to avoid it and therefore I won't get it and I won't become ill or disabled or whatever, which is also like such a societal problem that we have with ableism that it genuinely blows my mind and that other people can't see it. But it is very much that, okay, so if you tell me how you got your disability, I can avoid it and I can avoid becoming disabled, which in and of itself is a massive problem and it's why we do the work we do, right? Like, we wouldn't do it if we didn't feel so strongly about it.
So true. Yeah, like we just want to educate so people can, why are people scared of things like this? I think because, I mean, when I was a kid, I think, you know, when you're so young and you don't really understand about yourself, I was probably a bit scared of having CP. I probably was at a point. I think any kid who realizes they're different is probably going to be freaked out, but then you kind of grow up and grow out of it, and then you see kind of grown adults having that same fear. Or I don't know, maybe someone's born into the family with a disability, and that's like the worst thing ever for that child, apparently. And this child's just been born. Like, I've seen and I've heard it happen, and it's really sad. People get super freaked out, don't they? Because they don't know how to deal with it or how to cope with it.
Yeah. I always think that when people are like, oh, you know, a baby being born disabled is the worst thing that could happen, I always think, actually, death is probably a bit worse.
Fully. People don't see it, they're like, oh, bad luck. It's just, yeah, so we really need to shift people's way of thinking with that, because there are so many amazing adults thriving with a disability.
Yeah,
not despite, not like, you know, it's just a part of them, period. That's it. It's just a part of that person.
Yeah. But I love that so much. Not despite, not in spite of, with. They have a disability and like accept it because they're absolutely thriving. So if you don't like it, that says way more about you than it does about them.
Doesn't it? It's so true.
Yeah.
So true.
I've got one final question for you, Abby, and I've loved this conversation. And thank you for being so candid about your experiences as well, because I know that not all of them are the easiest to talk about. And particularly when we're talking about ourselves, it's not always easy to be vulnerable. And I really appreciate you being vulnerable today. But my final question for you is, are you disabled and proud?
Yeah, of course I am, Brooke. Of course I am. That's why I'm here.
Like I said, thank you so much for coming on today. I've loved it. And you've spoken so openly and so honestly about your experiences. And I can only thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. It's been good. It's been quite like cathartic, actually, because, you know, I talk about access and things day to day, but I don't often go deep into myself. So it's been kind of nice to do that. A little Friday morning chit chat. I like it.
We love it. This is what we're here for. Disabled and proud, always and forever.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Brooke.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disabled and Proud. If you've enjoyed the show, then please give it some love by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps us to reach more and more people each week. Plus, if you've got a particular highlight, then I'd absolutely love to hear it. Tag me on your Insta stories at Disabled and Proud Podcast.